Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Thanks, Stu, at home for joining us this hour. It's good to be here. So he spent 21 years spying against the United States. He did it for money and who knows what else. But they did pay him. They paid him in cash. They also paid him in diamonds, which is a nice spy movie touch. But he spied against the U.S. for 21 years. And then for the next 21 years after that, he resided in federal prison. So 21 years as a spy against America, and then 21 years and counting in prison because of it before he died today in prison at the age of 79. It was Stop the Press's huge national news when they first caught him in 2001.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw.
Good evening. Tonight, the FBI has under lock and key one of its own, a veteran FBI agent with access to the most sensitive and highly classified information in the United States government.
FBI agents today searched the suburban Washington home of one of their own in the worst spy case in FBI history. Robert Philip Hansen, a 25-year veteran of the FBI, accused of doing, quote, extreme damage to the U.S., passing on super-sensitive classified information to his Soviet and then Russian handlers in Washington.
The criminal conduct alleged represents the most traitorous actions imaginable against a country governed by the rule of law.
The most traitorous actions imaginable. His name was Robert Hansen. He first joined the FBI in 1976. He moved up fast from the New York field office where he was first hired to FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. And the part of the FBI that he worked in, his sort of area of specialty, was the part of the FBI that kept tabs on Russia, that kept tabs on Russia, specifically running spies inside this country. Hansen worked at that part of the FBI that kept track of spying operations that the Soviet Union was running here in the U.S. targeting us. He worked in FBI counterintelligence, the part of the FBI that watched for Russian spies and tried to stop them here in America. And among other things, that meant that he knew a lot about Russian spying operations in the United States, more than almost anybody else in the country. And that meant, in very practical terms, that when he decided that he himself wanted to become a Russian spy in the United States, he knew exactly who to go to and exactly how to do it. He was only at the FBI for about 3 years before he decided to become a traitor. He joined the FBI in 1976. By 1979, they think he was on the Russian payroll, stealing U.S. secrets and giving them to Moscow. Among the stuff he gave them were the names of Russians who were secretly working for the United States inside Russia. After he gave his Russian handlers those names of Russians who were secretly working for the U.S., those people were rounded up by the Soviet authorities and executed. He also told his Russian handlers about the fact that the FBI and the NSA had built a secret tunnel under the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., basically as a way of bugging the embassy so the U.S. could spy on them. Robert Hansen told the Soviets about that tunnel under their embassy, which, of course, blew up that whole operation. In 2007, after he was in prison, this movie was made about the case, a movie called Breach, starring Chris Cooper as the spy, Robert Hansen, starring Ryan Philippe as this young go-getter FBI agent to whom Hansen was a huge jerk and who gets assigned to this nerves of steel operation to catch Hansen in the act of being a spy. It's a good movie. It's got a very high creep factor. You can kind of tell from the coloration here. Like, it's got kind of a creepy Hitchcockian vibe throughout, which seems totally appropriate given the facts of the real world case. But even that movie, Breach from 2007, even that good movie is nothing compared to the real live footage. This is real footage. Look here. Of the real Robert Hansen being arrested when that nerves of steel operation inside the FBI to catch him in the act actually did catch him in the act. This is the actual moment when he was taken into custody. He was at a park in Fairfax, Virginia, a place called Foxstone Park. He had just left a dead drop for his Russian handler. The FBI had been watching him and they swooped in and arrested him. That was 2001. And again, it was national news. It's a huge deal all over the country. Hansen pled guilty to 15 counts of espionage. He pled guilty to avoid the death penalty. He was arrested in 2001, sentenced in 2002 to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that is where he was, in prison without the possibility of parole, when he died today at the age of 79. Given the type of high-level secret information that Hansen gave first to the Soviets and then to the Russians, given the body count that is attributed to him, Robert Hansen's story is considered one of the most damaging U.S. intelligence disasters we have ever had as a country, and we've had a few. It's also just one of the darkest stories that we have when it comes to intrigue about Russia. And there are quite a few of those stories, even just in today's news alone. Today in Russia, somebody figured out how to get a fake speech by Vladimir Putin broadcast on Russian TV and radio. This is early this afternoon, Russia time. It appears somebody hacked into at least one Russian TV network and radio network. They broadcast a fake speech by Vladimir Putin in which Putin appeared to be announcing that Russia had been invaded by Ukraine, that all Russian civilians should evacuate from three Russian provinces that border Ukraine. He said in this fake address that he was instituting martial law throughout Russia, and Russia was going into full military mobilization, which would be a full draft of everybody eligible to be fighting, to go fight the war. None of that was real, but somebody had the wherewithal to piece together a pretty good-looking fake broadcast to make it look and sound like that's what Putin was telling the Russian people today. And it ran this afternoon on Russian television and radio. It's like a War of the Worlds thing, right? But at a time and in a place where there actually is a war on. Now, I say that this fake today, it was pretty good. It wasn't particularly good. But it could have been. I mean, this is now the era of widely available artificial intelligence technology and very cheap, very accessible technology for making so-called deep fakes, right? This thing could very easily get very, very good very quickly, but we already know there's an appetite for it in this war. I mean, this happened today. This fake Putin broadcast happened today in Russia on a day when the Ukrainian military did start making what they're calling significant territorial gains, significant enough that some analysts in the United States are wondering if maybe today was the kickoff of the Ukrainian military's big counterpunch in that war, their big plan for a counteroffensive to take back the territory that Russia has seized from them in this war. It's interesting. There's enough uncertainty about that we've got these great competing headlines running tonight on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Can we put them both up there at the same time? As you see there on the left, there's the New York Times tonight, right now. As Ukrainian attacks surge, U.S. officials see signs of counteroffensive. Literally at the same time in the Washington Post tonight, here's their contrary headline. Ukrainian forces advance on Russians, deny counteroffensive has begun. So we don't know whether the big, you know, much anticipated Ukrainian counterpunch has happened, whether or not the counteroffensive has begun, and whether or not it would make sense for them to formally announce it if it has begun. I mean, either way, if you think about it, this would not be a crazy time to, you know, pair a major new military effort with a weird big technological psyop designed to freak out Russia's population and make the Russian people question whether they should believe that's the real Vladimir Putin when they see somebody that looks like him on TV. So maybe the Ukrainian counteroffensive has started. Maybe it hasn't. This fake Putin broadcast today is a very weird intervention into sort of psychological morass in which that war is happening on both sides of that border. And there's more that's strange going on. The Russians also have this private, for-profit mercenary army, right? The Wagner Group, which is fighting alongside the actual Russian army in the Ukraine war. In the past couple of days, we're getting reports that Russian forces have started shooting at the Wagner Group. And in response, the Wagner Group has just arrested and kidnapped a Russian general. I don't know what Ukraine really thinks of their odds overall in mounting their so-called, you know, counteroffensive militarily. But honestly, it can't be a bad thing for Ukraine if the two entities that invaded them and have been fighting them have now started shooting at each other and kidnapping each other's generals instead of fighting Ukraine. I'm sure from a Ukrainian perspective, that seems fine. It's all happening. I've got a new podcast that's about to come out. It's called Rachel Maddow Presents Deja News. First episode comes out a week from tonight, next week, so I'll tell you more about it then. But the trailer just came out today. It's out right now. If you want to check out the trailer, if you could follow the show for free so you can get the new episodes when they come out. You can do all of that at msnbc.com/Deja News. Again, it's just the trailer that's out now. The episode number one comes out next week. But the basic idea of this new podcast is that, deja vu all over again, kind of. The basic idea is that we keep having things happen in the news that seem totally unprecedented, that seem bizarre and new and out of the blue. But in fact, there is precedent. There is something else like this that has happened before. And maybe learning about that historical precedent can help us better understand what otherwise feels overwhelming or super unfamiliar in today's news. That's the basic idea of this Rachel Maddow Presents Deja News podcast, which, again, is sort of just launching today. But with all the Russia intrigue in today's news, right, with Robert Hansen dying, this massively damaging Russian spy, with the fake Putin speech being mysteriously broadcast on Russian TV and radio, with the bizarre dog-eat-dog fighting between real Russian soldiers and paid Russian mercenaries who were supposed to be on the same side in the war, with all that crazy news today, the deja news moment that I have been having today is one from 2018 from the Trump administration. Do you remember the do not congratulate saga? Do you remember this? This was 5 years ago, 2018. The Washington Post broke this bizarre story about then President Trump getting briefed by his national security advisors. He was about to get on a phone call with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. By then, it was pretty well established that Trump didn't like getting too much in print in terms of briefing materials. So the Washington Post reported March 2018. That Trump's advisors made sure that they put one thing in his briefing letter, in his briefing papers, in all capital letters. Basically, the idea being, okay, we know you don't like to read, but if you only take away one thing, if you only remember one thing we're telling you as you get on this call, just remember this. We're going to put it in all capital letters on a piece of paper on your desk in front of you while you're talking to him. And what we're going to tell you to do, you can't forget this. Do not congratulate. That was in all capital letters right in front of him while they put him on the phone with Putin. Now, the reason they did that is because Russia had just had some elections, ostensibly. They were not real elections. It was therefore important that the president of the United States shouldn't endorse the purported outcome of these elections as if they were real. So there's this three-word note in his briefing materials. Whatever else you say to this guy, do not congratulate. And then what happened? Trump, of course, got on the phone with Putin and immediately said, I want to congratulate you, sir, on your great election victory. It's the one thing he was supposed to not say. Do not congratulate. It's the first thing he said to the guy. That was 2018. Deja news. Because this was this weekend. Congratulations, Kim Jong-un. Or as he spelled it, Kim Jong-un. I mean, lots of foreign leaders' names are hard to spell. Kim Jong-un is not one of those names. I just gotta say, but still, it's pretty much phonetic. It's Kim Jong-un. How hard is that? But still, he misspelled it. More to the point, though, in general, American politicians in no circumstances should be congratulating the dictator of North Korea on anything. I mean, barring Kim Jong-un, like, stepping down and apologizing, that might be the only thing you'd congratulate him for. Otherwise, do not congratulate. Standing order when it comes to the dictator of North Korea. But there's Trump warmly congratulating Kim Jong-un and misspelling it in the meantime. And, you know, in a normal political world, somewhere between you deciding to congratulate the North Korean dictator and you misspelling that congratulations, somewhere between there, the idea of you as presidential material would like shred itself and blow away like a plastic bag on the median of a 10-lane highway. But instead, you know, he's still the front runner of the Republican Party's presidential nominating contest for 2024. Do not congratulate. And all the other candidates in that race, and there are many of them now, they're all sort of struggling with what to do, even with something that bad, with something that obviously wrong, even with this guy issuing warm congratulations to the North Korean dictator. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, he was asked about this, and he managed to say that he was, quote, surprised to see that congratulations from former President Trump for the dictator of North Korea. He said he was surprised. Surprised, really? I mean, Trump expressing warm, misspelled congratulations to the North Korean dictator is a lot of things, but is it surprising, really? You really didn't see that coming? Really didn't see this exact thing from him before? The other way this is turning into a deja news sort of thing is, of course, the overall size of the 2024 field on the Republican side. I mean, there's a reason this feels familiar. In 2016, the Republican presidential field was the biggest Republican presidential field ever. There were 17 different candidates in 2016 who ran for the Republican presidential nomination. That was that party's biggest field ever. But of course, it all just dissolved into an amorphous contest between Trump and all the other candidates who were not Trump. He started off as a joke at the outset, very quickly became the front runner, and then he instantly dispatched all the 16 other candidates who tried to run as not him, instead of just running against him. They all tried to run as the alternative to Trump instead of actually running against Trump. That's what happened in 2016. That's how Trump got the nomination in 2016. Today, it looks like we might be on pace to have just as big a field. Mike Pence is now getting in the race as of today. Before that, we got Ron DeSantis. Before that, we got Nikki Haley and Tim Scott and Asa Hutchinson and some others I can't even remember off the top of my head. It's looking like this week we're about to get Chris Christie and also maybe the governor of North Dakota, whose name is Doug. There's going to be a lot of them in the field again, apparently. And it's not clear yet if any of them have learned the lessons of 2016, if any of them are going to try to run against Trump instead of just running as someone who's not him. Today, though, with news of the reconvening of the D.C. grand jury considering federal criminal charges against Trump, with news that another federal grand jury is considering something related to Trump in Florida, something we didn't previously know, with Trump's attorneys meeting with Justice Department officials in D.C., including meeting with the special counsel himself in Washington, with Trump's existing attorneys reportedly shopping around for yet more Trump attorneys. They apparently are looking specifically for defense lawyers with federal trial experience in Washington. Today, at least, all of this news makes it appear that part of the preparation for Republican presidential politics this year is going to be everybody preparing for a potential federal criminal indictment of the frontrunner over and above the state criminal charges he is already facing. And if we end up with a doubly indicted Republican Party presidential frontrunner, that would be a new thing in our politics. We've got the latest on that ahead tonight. Plus, we've got a big policy challenge for the Biden administration to talk about tonight. This is something the Obama administration also faced. They were able to basically handle it, basically take a strong stand that made a difference. The Biden administration is now trying to do that, too. It is proving to be very difficult for them. We've got an in-depth report on that coming up next. It's all ahead. A lot to get to tonight. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
Do you personally dislike homosexuals?
Of course, they are disgusting. What sort of people are they?
That was the president of Uganda in 2014. That was the day after he signed into law a really radical piece of legislation. It was referred to worldwide as the Kill the Gays Bill, because the original version of that law called just for that, called for executing people for the grave crime of being gay. Now, if you've been watching this show from the beginning, you might remember that we covered the fight over that law extensively at the time, not just because it was so extreme, but also because there was a big American connection to it. Some of the architects of that bill were Americans, radical, anti-gay, evangelical activists and preachers who went to Uganda to sell what they couldn't get done here in this country to a different country where they thought they could get away with it. These groups carried on a multi-year campaign to get radical anti-gay legislation passed in Uganda. And they succeeded. In 2014, the Kill the Gays law was signed into law in Uganda. And what happened next was interesting. It was not just the expected legal challenges within that country. We also saw a very strong stand from the Obama White House at the time. This was from the Obama administration's press release at the time. Quote, "We want human rights abusers worldwide to know their misdeeds are not unnoticed, and would-be human rights abusers to understand that there are consequences for engaging in such actions. The State Department is therefore taking steps to restrict the entry into the United States of specific Ugandan individuals involved in serious violations or abuses of human rights, including those determined to have committed such violations or abuses against LGBT individuals." That was the Obama administration in 2014. The Obama administration also pushed that country in other really specific ways. They canceled joint military exercises that the U.S. had planned with Uganda. The Obama administration pulled millions of dollars that had been planned to be given to that country in support of their country's policing. The U.S. at the time had planned to open a national public health institute in Uganda. Instead, the Obama administration withdrew the millions of dollars it had planned for that endeavor and moved the entire institute to another country instead. The Obama White House used all these powers at its disposal. And it seems to have made a difference. I mean, those efforts were not the only reason that Uganda's anti-gay law fell apart in 2014, but it fell apart. The law was challenged in court there in Uganda by human rights activists and civil rights groups, by MPs and academics and journalists. It was eventually struck down by Ugandan courts on technical grounds. But the big shove on this issue from the United States, by all accounts, made a difference. Now in 2023, it's back. It's worse in some ways. And this new legislation, once again, comes against a backdrop of Americans being involved in it. Once again, a backdrop of U.S. anti-gay evangelical groups pouring pouring resources into advocating for this anti-gay agenda in Uganda. And now that same Ugandan president, the one who said he thinks gay people are disgusting, he has now signed into law an even harsher piece of legislation than what was passed in 2014. This new bill imposes, yes, the death penalty for what they call aggravated homosexuality. Life in prison for anybody engaging in gay sex. This new law makes it illegal to even advocate for LGBTQ people to have rights. Even advocacy of gay rights carries a penalty of 20 years in prison. If you are LGBTQ, you are living in Uganda right now, it is an understatement to say the situation on the ground there is terrifying. Lots of people are fleeing the country. Other people have not left their homes since the legislation was signed into law for fear they will be targeted either by the government or by mob justice. So it's happening again. This time it's worse. Here's a question for us. Is there an American government response that could be helpful here in the way that the U.S. response, that strong response, was helpful in 2014? How much of a special responsibility does the U.S. have in fixing things, given the role of certain Americans in cultivating this stuff over there? But also, does the U.S. have a special opportunity as a country, not just a responsibility to do it, but an opportunity to help, given that we've done it before? I mean, so far, the Biden administration has talked about measures, is considering measures that very much track exactly with what the Obama White House did the last time around when this was in the headlines in 2013 and 2014. The question is whether or not 10 years down the road, that's enough. Whether the U.S. could be doing something else or pushing even more aggressively. Because the Ugandan government obviously knew what to expect from us. They saw it 10 years ago. They went ahead and did it anyway this time, in full anticipation of what we would do. So can the U.S. response be amped up to account for that? For how much more danger people are at, particularly since we are part of the problem for how we got into this mess in the first place. Where do we go from here? Joining us now is Adrian Jucco. He is the executive director of the Human Rights Awareness and Promotion Forum, which advocates for marginalized groups in Uganda. Mr. Jucco helped coordinate the successful legal challenge to Uganda's anti-gay bill in 2014. Once again, he is now being pressed into service. He has joined with other leading gay rights advocates in his country to file a petition to try to have this latest law thrown out. Mr. Jucco, thank you very much for being here. It's good to meet you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
First, let me just ask if anything I said seemed wrong to you, if I got any of that the wrong way around.
No, everything is correct and accurate.
In terms of the U.S. responsibility for things being so bad, I don't want to overstate that. Obviously, this is internal dynamics in your country that are largely driving this. Right. As an American watching this process, though, knowing that Americans have been in Uganda advocating for this, mm-hmm. it's upsetting. It's heartening to know that we've made it worse. Have Americans been part of bringing this around again?
Yeah, I think the major question here is around the anti-gay groups, really, mm-hmm. American conservatives coming into Uganda and exporting the hate. And if we don't stop it now, I think it will spread to the whole of Africa. Look at what's happening in Ghana, look at what's happening in Kenya. So America still has a big role to play in this.
So the U.S. has been pretty successful in advocating for this in Uganda, but you think that these same anti-gay American evangelical groups want this in as many African countries as they can get it.
That's absolutely their agenda. We saw that recently they had a meeting in Entebbe with the president of Uganda and many other people from across the continent. And this was the agenda that spreads across Africa.
In terms of the situation on the ground right now in Uganda, we've seen a lot of reporting. We spoke with Frank Mugisha on the show a couple of weeks ago about people anticipating the law passing, and now that the law is passed, just being afraid. Mm-hmm. Afraid not just of the law's enforcement, but afraid that the law effectively gives random Ugandan citizens encouragement to go be vigilantes, to go attack people on their own. Do you see it that way? Is that part of the fear right now?
That's what the law is doing, exactly. One of the uncertainties, if you ask me myself, before coming on the show, I was quite uncertain whether I'm not promoting homosexuality, because that's exactly what it means. Mm. We're not so sure what this means. So for an average Ugandan, what I'm doing right now would be promotion of homosexuality. Now, if you think of an average LGBT person, the question is, what's going to happen to me next? Mm. Am I going to be picked up and arrested? Am I going to be beaten? Am I going to be beaten by my neighbors? For example, now, right now we're working on about 7 cases of eviction of LGBTI persons by their landlords since the bill was signed into law last week.
The law was only signed last week, and you've already got seven cases of people who have been thrown out of their housing by their landlords.
Absolutely.
Because of the law.
Absolutely.
When this happened in 2013, 2014, we did see a strong response from the U.S. government. The Obama administration was strongly pushed back, publicly pushed back against it. And it appears from the observers that I've talked to that that did help.
Right.
It did have an influence.
All right. The
Biden administration has said a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. Is there more they could do? Are you happy with the response of the Biden administration so far?
I'm happy with the response so far. But for me, what I want is that we don't dictate what they say. It's them who decide what they say. Now, I want them to live up to what they promise. That's very important, because if they don't live up to what they promise, then everyone else is watching what's happening. And so Kenya, Ghana, and the other countries also take note and don't be like, oh, it happened in Uganda, nothing was done. It can also happen in our countries and nothing will be done. So for me, if the Biden administration says we are going to do this, then they should do it, because that's important.
So, for example, when the Biden administration says that there may be sanctions mm-hmm. on Ugandan officials mm-hmm. is an appropriate response here, you want to make sure if they effectively threaten that,
yes.
that in fact sanctions do follow.
That's what I would say, yes.
Adrian Jukko, Executive Director of the Human Rights Awareness and Promotion Forum. I know it is, as you just explained, it is a personal risk for you to be here talking about these things, given the way this law is set up. It
right.
makes me all the more grateful that you're here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you. Good luck. Stay in touch with us.
Thank you.
Adrian Jukko is the Executive Director of Human Rights Awareness and Promotion Forum in Uganda. All right, we've got much more ahead here tonight. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Did you get a meeting with the Attorney General?
We don't have any comment.
Did the Attorney General say why they wouldn't meet with you? Did you meet with Lisa Monaco, the Deputy Attorney General?
We don't have any comment. We don't have any comment. Please part so we can go to our waiting taxi cab. That was all we got today from lawyers for Donald Trump as they left a meeting of some sort at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. You might remember 2 weeks ago, the Trump legal team publicly asked for a meeting with Attorney General Merrick Garland. Lawyers for the former president said he was being treated unfairly by the special counsel who's looking into Trump's handling of presidential records, including classified documents. The FBI reported finding those documents in a search of Mar-a-Lago last year. While the Trump lawyers today did not get the meeting they wanted with the attorney general or with the deputy attorney general, Lisa Monaco, they did meet with a group of Justice Department officials that included at least one career prosecutor and that also included the special counsel himself, Jack Smith. Moments after that meeting let out, the former president himself posted a shouty, barely literate, misspelled message in all capital letters on social media that said, in part, "How could the Justice Department possibly charge me? Who did nothing wrong when no other presidents misspelled were charged?" He used to channel more of his excitement into exclamation points, I think. Now it all just goes into capital letters. I think pretty soon he's just going to be emojis, you know? Poo, poo, volcano, hammer, bunny. Ah! The federal grand jury in D.C. is expected to come back this week from a sort of break that they've been on. They're supposed to start in again on the Mar-a-Lago documents case. We don't know what that means in terms of the overall trajectory of the case. There's lots of speculation, but we will not know about what's happening before the grand jury until the grand jury speaks. Also, another federal grand jury is meeting in Florida on something related to Trump. We don't know what. The New York Times reports tonight that federal prosecutors there are expected to question a new witness before that Florida federal grand jury this week. Again, we don't know what's going on before that grand jury until the grand jury speaks, which is almost always only with an indictment, if they are going to speak at all. Right on time, Bloomberg News reports tonight that Trump is looking to add new lawyers to his already large legal team, specifically looking for lawyers with federal trial experience, which, if nothing else, means they are planning ahead for a potential federal trial. It's not your typical start to a Republican presidential primary. But as Donald Rumsfeld might say, you go to war with the politicians you have, not with the politicians you might wish to have. Joining us now is Brandon Van Grack. He's a former national security official at the Department of Justice, former prosecutor on special counsel Robert Mueller's team. Mr. Van Grack, thank you very much for joining us here tonight. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you about this.
It's my pleasure.
So the grand jury only lets us know what they're doing when an indictment is filed on the basis of the evidence that they have collected. It is a secretive process. That is not stopping everybody and their sister from speculating as to what the various publicly visible actions around grand jury rooms and courtrooms and Justice Department headquarters might mean. Do you feel like the tea leaf reading that's going on around these actions is accurate, given what you know about the federal investigative process?
Yeah, I think the tea leaves are accurate that we're going to see a charging document very soon. That's indicative of the fact that the former president's attorneys requested a meeting with the Department of Justice to try to convince them to not bring charges. And the former president's attorneys have more tea leaves, more signals than we do. And so I think it's just further evidence of the fact that it's going to be coming down soon.
I feel like a lot was made today over the fact that President Trump's attorneys had asked to meet with the attorney general. They did not meet with the attorney general. On the one hand, that means that they didn't get the direct thing they were requesting. On the other hand, it sort of seems correct, given that what they are complaining about is the special counsel's investigation. And by the very nature of a special counsel appointment, that investigation is supposed to be separate from the regular everyday work of the department, and the attorney general isn't supposed to be directly overseeing it. Is that fair?
That's right. I wouldn't read anything into the fact that the attorney general didn't take that meeting. It's not uncommon at the end of an investigation for the Department of Justice to offer a defendant's attorneys the opportunity to convince the decision maker, often the U.S. attorney for a district, an argument as to why they shouldn't be charged. And that's all that happened here. Ultimately, the special counsel is the decision maker, and the decision hasn't been made yet.
In terms of what the federal grand jury process is here and at what state it's at, it seems like there's a few different sort of slices of this to look at. One is the federal grand jury that's meeting in Washington looking at the handling of classified documents, the stuff that was seized at Mar-a-Lago. Based on the remit that Special Counsel Jack Smith was assigned, we believe that there is also a federal investigation at some stage that is looking at matters about the president, former president, trying to overturn the election results and how that might have contributed to January 6th. Now we're also hearing that there is a federal grand jury that is at work in Florida. It would seem that that's related to the classified documents part of this investigation. But again, it feels very opaque. It feels hard to parse from the outside. What do you make in terms of what's publicly known about what grand juries are meeting where and what they're looking at?
I mean, a couple things, which is one is we need to be careful about overinterpreting what piece of information that we get. I think in terms of Florida, it does seem just the fact that we're talking about Florida very likely connected to Mar-a-Lago. And I think there are perhaps three possibilities. One is it's possible the Mar-a-Lago case could be charged in Florida. There would be venue. There would be the ability to bring those charges there. I would still speculate it's more likely to see those charges in D.C. The second is that Special Counsel just simply wanted to obtain the testimony of an individual in Florida, and for convenience purposes chose to get that testimony in Florida. One grand jury testimony can present it to another grand jury. And the third possibility is there are other charges. There may be other individuals who may be charged, and perhaps Florida is the appropriate venue to charge those individuals.
From a prosecutor's perspective, is there a disadvantage to having related indictments brought in multiple jurisdictions? If there was going to be a D.C. indictment and a Florida indictment, for that matter, is there an advantage to being bringing your indictment in D.C. versus bringing it in Florida?
Well, a few pieces, which is there certainly would be a preference to bring like charges combined into one. But I think, in fact, it gets to one of your other points as well in terms of reading the tea leaves, which is time is of the essence. The Department of Justice, it's incumbent on them to try this case if there are going to be charges probably before March. And whenever every week that goes by, it makes that increasingly challenging to bring one of these cases involving the Espionage Act and classified information in 7 to 8 months. That's very challenging. And so every week that goes by, I think it makes it increasingly difficult to meet that goal.
Brandon Van Grack, very helpful perspective on that. Thanks for making time to join us tonight. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. Perhaps you noticed the absence today of a gigantic self-inflicted financial disaster for the U.S. economy. Today, things did not self-annihilate in an irreversible economic fireball of doom. It was a good day, and that is because over the weekend, President Biden signed the bipartisan deal passed by Congress to raise the U.S. debt ceiling, to keep the U.S. government paying its bills, thereby avoiding irreversible, self-inflicted, devastating economic catastrophe. Today, in the White House room where that deal was crafted, my beloved colleague, Lawrence O'Donnell, interviewed the White House team who helped negotiate that deal for their boss, President Biden.
The president's done this for, you know, his entire career. This is his superpower. He really does know how to negotiate what the considerations are that have to be balanced so that you can secure votes on both sides. And, you know, really establish a framework that we could negotiate within that made a difference so that we could get this done. I mean, that's really where it begins and ends.
As you can tell, even just from that clip, the Biden administration clearly considers the debt ceiling deal a big victory for them, victory for the country, but also a big political victory for the president. And of course, in some ways, it's also a victory for the guy who was on the other side of the negotiating table from them, Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who does get to enjoy a little spate of good headlines about himself for the first time in his adult life. With this deal being signed and disaster averted, really the only people in politics who seem unable to declare victory right now are the Republicans who opposed there being a deal, which I think it's fair to say is a problem for the Republican Party going forward. I mean, just as a general matter, it is not awesome to be on record as being in favor of disaster when other people were working to make sure the disaster didn't happen. But heading into this next year of politics, it's a problem that nearly every single one of their declared candidates for president is on record as opposing the debt ceiling deal and instead siding with the far right Republicans in Congress who didn't want a deal, the side that lost when the American economy won. It is hard to spin your opposition to saving the American economy as a good thing, right? Especially when it's like the whole field of candidates that you're putting forward for president. On the other hand, a win in politics counts only if you tell people about it. Today, a Democratic group that supports the Biden agenda began running a new ad about President Biden's role in brokering the deal. Here it is.
The economy was at risk of collapse, held hostage by MAGA Republicans and their threat of a catastrophic default if their extreme demands weren't met. But President Biden stood firm and negotiated a bipartisan compromise that protects Social Security and Medicare for seniors, expands benefits for veterans and their families, and preserves Medicaid for those in need. Thanks to President Biden, the American people have an economy that works for them.
I show you that as a political document because for my entire adult life, Democrats have been very shy about self-promotion. They thought it is rude to remark publicly on things you've done and done well. There is nothing shy about that. Tonight, you can watch the full interview with the White House team about how the debt ceiling deal came together. That's going to be on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, which is right after me. Trust me, you will want to stick around for that. That's going to do it for me for now.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.